This is Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. We'll change a little bit in terms of the conversation on how this show is going to take. Normally, I cover business. Normally, I cover tech. But of course, today, we shall talk about a greater issue on hand, which is, of course, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In fact, for this evening, I have with me in the show later, ICRC. For the past 10 years, the ICRC debate has been refocused on basically three things. The first, of course, the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons. The second, the lack of adequate humanitarian response capacity to a nuclear explosion. And of course, the third, the general incompatibility of nuclear weapons with international humanitarian laws. Accordingly, we want to understand better about the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons and the fact that such weapons are not compatible with the compliance of international human laws. This, of course, raises the question then on whether or not they are then already prohibited, and if so, why the need for the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or the TPNW. So to clarify that, while nuclear weapons are not compliant with the international humanitarian law principles, and the Nuclear Weapons Advisory Opinion also pronounces the applicability of the international human laws so that these weapons does not leave the room or leave the arsenal on the state actors doing it. Never even the idea of self-defense. The scale and scope of the devastation that the nuclear weapons have caused in the past are capable of causing in the future provides no sense of justification for this. Because of this, I have the privilege to invite the spokesperson from ICRC, Saha Haroon. She's the regional legal advisor there at ICRC. Sahar, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I want to understand a little bit better about why the ICRC is concerned with a complete ban and a complete elimination of nuclear weapons.
Right. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for this very timely question. If I may begin by painting a scenario for you, and if I may ask you to imagine a limited nuclear war involving only 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs, that is of 13 kilotons each, which is really less than even 0.5% of the world's nuclear weapons today. Today in the world, we have about more than 14,000 nuclear warheads in existence. And so what we're really talking about is a very small percentage of those weapons being used in a, let's say, a very targeted sort of nuclear war. What happens from all of that is the disruption of the climate. Number one, the global temperatures of the world would fall by an average of 1.3 degrees for several years. This in turn would shorten the growing season in many areas. The drop in temperature would also mean the decrease in precipitation. And by decrease in precipitation, you're saying that there would be a severe decrease in rainfall. So by all of this, more than 1 billion people would be estimated to be affected by starvation and facing food insecurity and food shortage as a result of this limited regional nuclear war. And all of this is not based on fiction. All of this, the ICRC, the world, has actually witnessed before. We've seen a trailer of what happens when nuclear weapons are used. We've seen the estimated casualties of the nuclear weapons being used in 1945. And if I can just quote a few figures for you. So for instance, in Hiroshima, at that point, when the nuclear weapon, the bomb was dropped, there were an estimated 100,000 to 140,000 deaths. So this is in addition to the climate and the environmental destruction that took place. Look at Nagasaki. There were 60,000 to 70,000 people being killed. The total area destroyed by heat, blast, and fire in Hiroshima covered about 13 square kilometers, while in Nagasaki, it was 6.7 square kilometers. And then the impact on the medical services in Hiroshima. So out of the 300 doctors present in the vicinity in Hiroshima, 270 of them were either killed or injured. Out of the nurses, that there were of whom there were 1,780, more than 1,650 nurses were killed or injured. And similarly, devastating numbers for pharmacists. So you can imagine the effects that all of that had on healthcare as well. And so, like you very rightly mentioned, for the ICRC, the debate on the prohibition of nuclear weapon and our work since 1945 over the last 75 years is really focused on framing this international discourse on nuclear weapons on three major concerns and three major issues, if I may say that. Number one being their catastrophic humanitarian consequences. The second one being the lack of adequate humanitarian response capacity to a nuclear explosion. And the third, the general incompatibility of nuclear weapons with international humanitarian law.
So if nuclear weapons are indeed incompatible with international humanitarian laws, why then aren't they already prohibited by all these state actors?
No, thank you very much for that question. So up until the adoption of the TPNW, IHL did not specifically prohibit nuclear weapons. However, their use in armed conflict was at that time still regulated by general rules of international humanitarian law, which restrict how weapons may be used and outline measures to be taken to implement their impact on civilians and civilian areas. And then there are five major rules under international humanitarian law that are relevant to such weapons, being on the rule of prohibiting attacks directed against civilians, or the rule prohibiting indiscriminate attack, the rule of proportionality in attack, the rule on the protection of natural environment, and the obligation to take feasible precautions in attack. In addition to that, there was this advisory opinion by the International Court of Justice in 1996, where they considered whether nuclear weapons could be legitimately used in any way. And while the court generally said that nuclear weapons would be contrary to the requirements of international law applicable in armed conflict, particularly the principles and rules of IHL, however, it left open this question of what happens in an extreme situation of self-defense in which the very survival of a state is at stake. In the ICRC's view, even at that point, there was indisputable evidence of nuclear weapons' catastrophic impact, and making it extremely doubtful that their use could ever comply with IHL. However, today, since earlier this year in 2021, where the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons came into force, and currently there are 56 countries who have ratified the TPNW, this is now a concrete and clear prohibition against the use of nuclear weapons.
Okay, so because of this, maybe you can help us explain briefly what the TPNW is, or the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, is all about. What does it cover? What are the obligations that all these state actors are going to be involved in? And what does it envision, generally speaking?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much. So there are four main areas, if I may slightly briefly elaborate on those, under the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So number one, it creates certain prohibitions. Number two, it goes into creating pathways for elimination of nuclear weapons. The third thing that it does is it has provisions in it on victim assistance and environmental remediation. And fourthly, provisions on international assistance and cooperation. So the first one, prohibition, it very clearly prohibits not just the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons, but also the development, test, production, manufacture, acquisition, possession, or stockpiling of nuclear weapons, but also transfer of nuclear weapons or stationing or installation of those. And lastly, it also prohibits in any way the assistance, encouragement, or inducement to engage in any activity that is prohibited under this treaty. So that is all on prohibition, and these are very comprehensive provisions under the treaty. On the second one, which is the elimination of nuclear weapons. So the treaty actually provides pathways for all states to eliminate their stock of nuclear weapons. And so applying to states who are party to it, who actually possess nuclear weapons, or they previously owned or possessed nuclear weapons, even states who themselves don't own nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons on behalf of another state are placed in their jurisdiction, and also lastly for those states who do not possess or own nuclear weapons. So if you look at those relevant provisions, then there are specific requirements that the TPNW asks of each of those states as they become party to the treaty. In terms of victim assistance and environmental remediation, the treaty recognizes the suffering and harm caused to the victims of nuclear weapon use and testing, as well as the impact on indigenous peoples and the environment. And this may bring to mind perhaps the stockpiling or the testing around Marshall Islands and what impact that has had on the environment for the indigenous people of the Pacific Islands. And lastly, international assistance and cooperation, where state parties must cooperate to facilitate the successful implementation of the treaty, and each state party has the right to seek and receive assistance to fulfill the treaty's requirement in terms of assistance and cooperation in order to eliminate its stockpiles, if there are any, of the nuclear weapons.
All right, there's a lot to unpack there, but for now, we have to go for one short break before we continue on our conversation with Saharun of the ICRC. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. This is Notepad. I have with me, joining us from Jakarta, Saharun, the Regional Legal Advisor for Southeast Asia and Japan. Sahar, currently there are various multilateral treaties on nuclear weapons, particularly the NPT or the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. How does the TPNW be seen or looked with or worked with the NPT, the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons? How does the TPNW affect these kind of treaties?
Thank you very much for that question. And this is a concern that we hear time and again. And many critics do express concern about the impact of the TPNW on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Yet, if you look at the TPNW, specifically its preamble, it explicitly affirms that the NPT is the cornerstone of nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation regime, and that its full and effective implementation has a vital role to play in promoting international peace and security. What the TPNW does is that it complements and supports the NPT's nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation objectives. Indeed, the TPNW's clear and comprehensive prohibition of nuclear weapons creates a further, if I may say so, disincentive for the proliferation of nuclear weapons and represents a concrete step towards implementing these non-proliferation and disarmament requirements of the NPT in order to pursue negotiations on effective measures for nuclear disarmament.
You wanted to add?
Yes, I was also just going to add that in addition to the NPT, there are other treaties as well, including regional treaties which create nuclear weapon-free zones across the world. And these treaties generally contain provisions on a wide range of nuclear weapon-related activities that are applicable in those regions where these treaties are in force, such as in Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, the Central and Southeast Asia. And so all of these regimes, they actually supplement and complement each other rather than creating different obligations or rather than being contrary to each other.
Okay, we know that Malaysia participated in the negotiation of the TPNW at the United Nations in New York in 2017. Malaysia was among the 122 states that voted in favor of its adoption, and it's in our opening statement, Malaysia said that our work here would have a political as well as a legal impact on the disarmament debate and give impetus to the movement and attain and maintain a nuclear weapon-free world. Now, this is, of course, the other one in the 122 states. Well, what steps can other states party to the TPNW, like Malaysia, must take and must move ahead on this matter, Sahar?
Mm-hmm. Right. So currently, like I said, at this point, there are 56 states who are party to the TPNW, including Malaysia. And so the first thing that such states need to be doing is the adoption of domestic measures. And by that mean, we mean national implementation. Under the TPNW, each state party is required to take the necessary measures to implement the obligations of the treaty. And so all the obligations that I was mentioning before in terms of prohibition, in terms of victim assistance, and all of those things. And in addition, states must take measures towards the elimination of nuclear weapons, the provision of international assistance and cooperation in accordance with their respective obligations under the treaties. So that is one, which is the adoption of domestic measures. But the second thing is also the meeting of state parties. So the first meeting of state parties for the TPNW is coming up in March 2022. And here, all these meetings essentially take place to assess the treaty's status and implementation, and then to take decisions to advance the elimination of nuclear weapons. So all states who are party to the TPNW would be attending this first meeting of the state parties, but also there can be other states who can join this first MSP or the meeting of state parties as observers. And all of this, there's a lot that the ICRC does with the view of supporting states towards national implementation as well as joining the TPNW. And we have a lot of tools that can assist states as well, such as a model law, such as a ratification kit, a fact sheet which explains what the TPNW is, and other briefing notes on the interpretation of specific provisions of the TPNW to further assist states in terms of understanding what the TPNW is requiring of them.
You know, what I find strange here is that no nuclear-armed states have signed or ratified the TPNW. Now, of course, I understand why they haven't signed on it, but what does it mean for them?
Right. If I may first very respectfully disagree with the statement that this is a position that is understandable. For the ICRC, it is difficult to see how nuclear weapons, the use of which, even on a limited scale, as I was speaking about before, would have catastrophic and long-lasting humanitarian consequences, can be considered as instruments of security. And to further perhaps elaborate on that, if I may take the liberty to quote the statement from ICRC's President Peter Maurer to this high-level signing ceremony of the TPNW back in 2017, where he said that most states today see nuclear weapons as a major source of insecurity for their populations and for future generations. True security can only happen with progress on nuclear disarmament, and this progress is urgently needed. And indeed, this nuclear disarmament is a humanitarian imperative. And by signing and ratifying the TPNW, states fulfill their responsibility to protect humanity from nuclear catastrophe. And it is important to remember that none of us are safe as long as one of us is not safe. So that is an important humanitarian perspective to keep in mind, because the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons cannot be controlled in time, space, nor geography. And so all those states who see nuclear weapons as a, in terms of a doctrine on of national security, perhaps forget what it means for insecurity.
All right, I think I get what we're getting at right now. But one more short break before we conclude our conversation with Harun of ICRC. This is Notepad. The conversation for today is, of course, the TPNW, the idea of how we can talk better in better understanding of how the nuclear weapons need to be discussed or approached. So far, we've had a long conversation with Saha Harun, the regional legal advisor, ICRC. And of course, Saha, we just want to understand a bit better about the notion of why does the TPNW matter to countries or to states who are not armed with nuclear weapons, like Malaysia, like Indonesia, like many others around us. Why should such states become party to a document like the TPNW?
Absolutely. So yes, you're absolutely right that in fact, majority of the countries around the world are currently not armed with nuclear weapons. And yet the ICRC, for instance, we continuously advocate with all states to become party to the TPNW. And the primary reason behind that is this threat of the and the risk of the use of nuclear weapons with the existence of, as I said before, 14,000 nuclear heads today, nuclear warheads today. There is this continued threat, especially with also advancing technology, including of a new nuclear arms race, the instability and the impact of which cannot be controlled in any of those ways that I mentioned before. And so in order to just conceptualize this ever-increasing risk of nuclear weapons being used, according to, there can be, I would say, four risk of use scenarios. Number one is a doctrinal use of nuclear weapons, that is the use of nuclear weapons as outlined and envisaged in declared policies, doctrines, strategies, or concepts, or whatever. And the second one being an escalatory use, so that is the use of nuclear weapons in an ongoing situation of tension or conflict. The third would be unauthorized use, that is the non-sanctioned use of nuclear weapons by a non-state actor. And fourthly, accidental use, that is the use of nuclear weapons through error, including technical malfunction and human error. And so the only way to guarantee that nuclear weapons are never used again is by prohibiting and eliminating them. And what it means for states who are not party, for states who are not armed with nuclear weapons and why should they become party, is in order to further cement this taboo against the use as well as the threat of use of nuclear weapons and to reduce this risk of nuclear weapons ever being used.
Of course, does the entry into force of the TPNW mean that the nuclear threat is no longer around? Or what do you think of this whole notion of us moving ahead when it comes to the nuclear question?
Right. So the TPNW, which was adopted in 2017 by 122 states, is really the first internationally legally binding instrument which prohibits nuclear weapons. And in that way, and obviously since being in force from earlier this year in 2021, it does fill a legal gap. This gap being that nuclear weapons were previously the only weapon of mass destruction not expressly prohibited under international humanitarian law. However, today, prohibiting nuclear weapons, I would say, is the beginning and not the end of our efforts. At the ICRC, we continue to be deeply concerned at the increasing risk of the use of nuclear weapons as evidenced by the erosion of nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation framework, B, the continued modernization of nuclear weapons, and C, the adoption of more aggressive nuclear weapons doctrines. And so in reality, the success of the TPNW and its impact will depend on the broadest possible adherence by a wide variety of states, including neutral states, developing countries, religious leaders, those associated with nuclear weapon-based military arrangements, and eventually by all states. And if I can just conclude by saying that the concrete evidence now available of the massive, indiscriminate, and irreparable health and environmental and societal impacts of nuclear weapons and of their inconsistency with IHL should not be weighed against unpredictable security scenarios or questions about the impacts of the TPNW that will only be answered by historians. Judgments about the TPNW should be based on the responsibility of all states to protect humanity from this scourge of a nuclear catastrophe that would add extraordinary levels of human suffering to current unmet needs, and on the long-standing obligations that states have under international humanitarian law as well as disarmament law.
You know, Sahar, I mean, talking about all this, we just want to understand a little bit better about what the regular folk, people like you and me and the audiences that are watching us right now on their devices at home or on their phones, wherever they are, what can the regular folk do when it comes to the issue of nuclear power?
Right. Now, thank you very much for that question. And so if I can just explain that at the ICRC, we work in terms of advocacy, not just with authorities, but with all actors like you've mentioned. So be it academia, be it civil society, be it religious leaders, and be it youth groups, for instance. Because we feel that there is a role that everybody can play in terms of understanding the catastrophic humanitarian consequences that nuclear weapons can have and have had in the past, and thereby really working with the states and really influencing and mobilizing all these different actors to become party to the TPNW, and for states who are party to the TPNW, for them to then work towards national implementation and elimination and fulfilling the obligations under the TPNW. So this is where the work of all of these different actors come into play, where they can actually mobilize their states and influence their states towards universal adherence of the TPNW.
All right, thank you very much. That was Sahar Harun, the ICRC Regional Legal Advisor for Southeast Asia and Japan. Now, there's a lot of questions that still needs to be asked, particularly to state actors. Please chime in your views. Tweet to me at IbrahimSaniNet, wherever you find me on social media, to continue on this conversation even further. Like I said, we took a different turn for this show. Normally, we did talk about a little bit of government, but you know, normally we explore on the issue of business and tech. But this is, of course, a long-standing issue that needs to be debated all the time. Of course, if you've missed any part of this interview, just head on to astroawani.com. Look for Notepad over there. You can also search for TPNW on astroawani.com. You can also search for ICRC on astroawani.com. Till then, thanks very much for watching and goodbye.